Chapter 54. Discussion. In any story, much is left, or should be left, on the cutting room floor as editorial discipline strives to create a cohesive, flowing narrative. This is certainly true for the autism vaccine, and this final chapter should serve as a clearinghouse, liner notes, if you will, bits and bobs, the flotsam and jetsam that didn't find a home along the arc you have just circumscribed. The third-person omniscient voice in which the story was told will now switch to a first-person account as I take off my coat, roll up my sleeves, and do away with any formalities. I hope that any questions you may have developed along the way will be answered within this chapter, but alas, there is much more to be done, and I do not have the answers to everything. I have hypotheses for many things, but additional scientific inquiry is badly needed to support or jettison that which I have proposed. Just as I was finishing this manuscript, I announced the launch date and title of the book through social media. As autism and vaccines have become such a contentious subject, the reaction was predictably pronounced. A petition was started asking Amazon and Apple, the printed, digital, and audiobook distributors, to ban the work from their platforms. A counter-petition was launched, and the ensuing race turned into an online signature war. A much more serious battle is being waged within the political sphere as many states consider removing more personal liberties, specifically in regard to what medical procedures might be required against someone's consent. The furor over the issue has even reached the federal level, where just recently, one-sided discussions were presented before government officials as if it were a balanced overview of the debate. The politicians making profound decisions about our personal liberties are woefully lacking in both medical and historical knowledge about their potential impact. It is frightening to see immature, hysterical charlatans signal their virtue to the world by repeating tropes they have never bothered to research for themselves. They mean well, of course, but so too did many of history's worst dictators. Regardless, the autism vaccine may have arrived at the perfect time. The debates are raging, and mandatory vaccination laws are being drafted left and right that will likely increase the rates of the disorder. If the story I have told is true, we have a very big problem on our hands, the likes of which no one, me, or anyone else, is prepared to deal with. If the story I have told is true, we may have inadvertently created generations of damaged children that will extend far beyond the cessation of what initially caused it. For as many of these girls grow up to become mothers, they may, without any additional vaccines, have other problems to deal with. This particular issue, maternal immune activation, creates another serious dilemma. Many are pushing for the mother of all scientific studies, a large vaccinated versus unvaccinated cohort to compare the rates of autism and other illnesses, a final piece of research that could settle the debate once and for all. There is nothing unethical about this type of research, as there are plenty of unvaccinated children at this point. If children were asked to forgo vaccines as part of the study, it might be considered problematic, but as they already exist in nature, there should be no issue. Unfortunately, this study may be too late. If maternal immune activation is an actual problem, which it appears to be, the unvaccinated children of these mothers may be affected by vaccines she received as a child. As a result, the study would actually need to be modeled with vaccinated versus unvaccinated mothers and their unvaccinated children. Even then, with some scientists suggesting the problem could extend across multiple generations, the reverberations of vaccines and the aluminum they contain may still be felt decades from now. Another insidious problem exists. The issue regarding vaccines and autism has become so impassioned that most people will doubt whatever a study determines if it does not suit their liking. This is particularly true for the parents who have asked government health officials to conduct more adequate safety studies on the vaccine schedule as currently administered to children, a request which has been met with silence. Even if such a trial were to be conducted, based on their past track records, few would likely trust the results. In short, it does not feel like government health agencies have the ability to be honest anymore. they are so heavily invested in aggressive public vaccinations, their policies regarding its administration so totalitarian, it has become difficult to accept them at their word. Today, on the Centers for Disease Control website are several half-truths and outright fabrications regarding the potential association between autism and vaccines. CDC officials have been called out, shown the errors using their own previous research as proof, and yet the errors remain, a testament to the unflagging confidence in vaccines they feel they must project. There are many who don't trust that vaccines are as safe as they have been told, and unfortunately, in the attempt to prop up the loss of faith, public health agencies have shown themselves to be untrustworthy, nearly always siding with their pharmaceutical counterparts over any concerns of parents. Because of this, we would seem to be at an impasse. Current public health officials have squandered the trust and respect bestowed upon them from the decades of hard work of their predecessors. The public is losing faith in vaccines altogether, and the despotic maneuvers being enabled to ensure their forced administration will do nothing to restore it. The physicians and nurses who routinely turn a blind eye when parents suggest vaccines have harmed their children are equally complicit. Some fear for their jobs, but most blindly reject any claim of harm from a parent if it involves a vaccine. Because of this, many parents with children who have clearly been injured by their immunizations have returned for another round or two of shots, only to see their children regress even further. This has created enmity between doctors and their patients, a disconnect clearly audible in the tone of nearly any vaccine-related conversation during a pediatric visit. A large database set up to document issues called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, is nearly unused by most doctors and nearly unknown by most parents. Even after insisting their child was harmed by a vaccine, many doctors will refuse to log the event into VAERS, fearful of the repercussions it might cause. As a result, many parents are left to fend for themselves, unsatisfied with the vague diagnosis given to them by their doctors, a label often designed to avoid implicating vaccinations as a cause, rather than providing insight into options for recovery. It is a strange phenomenon to witness. If any other medicine prescribed by a doctor caused a reaction, hives, headaches, fatigue, they would immediately ask you to stop using it and look for alternatives. If a mother reports her baby having seizures for the first time in their life on the way home from a shot visit, she will often be dismissed as paranoid or a conspiracy theorist for believing vaccines harmed her child. This is the madness of vaccinations and one of the main reasons people are quickly losing faith in them. The obvious cover-ups their pediatricians or doctors engage in has nearly ruined their profession. I hope this book and others like it begin a much-needed discussion on the likelihood that vaccines play a significant role in the onset of autism. We have exhausted all other options save this one, an obvious cause that doctors, famous throughout history for their inability to examine themselves as a potential cause for their patient's suffering, have never looked at. For those of you keeping track at home, there have been numerous epidemiological studies looking at the MMR vaccine and autism. Currently, there are very few that look at any of the numerous other vaccines, particularly when it comes to aluminum-containing shots, and certainly none that examine the entire schedule as recommended. As I mentioned earlier, it is unfortunate that I do not even bother to ask for studies anymore, so confident am I they would not be conducted honestly and with integrity. I have said it elsewhere, but I believe science is simply history without the guns, a collection of events that happened and are retold according to the bias of the observer. There is nothing, particularly with epidemiological studies, from preventing any capable scientist from manipulating the cohorts, filtering or holding out certain people groups to more closely resemble the result those who funded the research were looking for. With bench science or studies created in the lab, this becomes a bit more difficult. Regrettably, proving vaccines can cause autism is much easier than proving they cannot. In the laboratory, injecting animals with enough aluminum would certainly cause some of them to develop the behavioral deficiencies of autism. In the field, where epidemiologists collect and sift through reams of data, the results of bench scientists can be invalidated with the click of a mouse. A final difficulty in employing science to understand that which history has already shown: fear. Any study which seeks to understand the way in which vaccines may cause autism, either through encephalitis or direct neurotoxic harm, must replicate the fear a child experiences when taken into a doctor's office for the fifth or sixth time, pinned down to a table by nurses, possibly their own parents, and injected multiple times. I believe this to be the single most important factor in the onset of neurological injury through vaccination, an onset which often coincides with the age at which they show the most fear. In animal studies, the way stress is often induced is specifically by restraint, the same mechanism often employed in the administration of pediatric vaccines. Obviously, no scientific study on Earth would receive funding or ethical approval using this design, a clear indication as any to me that perhaps what we're doing every day, without giving it a second thought, may in fact be very wrong. If a university study wouldn't dare allow such a study to happen, and a pharmaceutical company wouldn't dare fund it, we must ask ourselves, why are we allowing the creation of laws to force our children to undergo the exact same thing, many times throughout their childhood, rather than the once or twice a study would likely entail? There has to be a better way. Ironically, the reason so many ignore the obvious cause of autism is because of the intense fear they themselves feel. If vaccines do cause autism, then what do we do? We can't stop vaccinating, they might say. Vaccines have saved humanity from certain death. For those who truly believe this, it is understandable how autism and vaccines create such anxiety and hysteria. They are truly afraid of what the future might hold if vaccines are in fact the only thing standing between a life well lived and the death of millions. The scope of this discussion is too big for this book, but you can get a glimpse of why many of the pediatric vaccines on our current schedule are in fact unnecessary in another book I've written called Unvaccinated: Why Increasing Numbers of Parents Are Choosing Natural Immunity to Protect Their Children. It is a short book you can read in an afternoon and offers a quick dip in the pool. If all of these pediatric vaccines were completely necessary and they were causing autism, we would be in a real mess. Fortunately, most of them are unnecessary in first world countries, and the solution to end autism may in fact be fairly inconsequential. It will never happen when fear is so effectively employed to manipulate the ignorant into compliance. It will only happen once the majority of people have relearned how to think for themselves and are forced to rely upon themselves rather than the empty promises of government officials. Enough about policy and the horrible state of affairs we now find ourselves in. Many of you are probably curious about some of the things mentioned in the book and would like to know more. So I will take a guess as to what they may be and attempt to address them as best I can. If the story of the Dion quintuplet struck you, you are not alone. I was captivated by their story as I did research into their lives. The Dions have been mentioned several times alongside Donald, autism's first child, because of how he named paint colors after them. I had never read much about them, but as I read through several books on the subject, came to cherish each and every one of them, even learning to differentiate the seemingly identical faces of Emily, Marie, Cecile, Yvonne, and Annette. The obvious question anyone who begins to learn about the Dions is, why did the government take them away? How could they get away with that? This question haunted me as I tried to understand how something akin to the medical kidnapping we might hear about today happened in broad daylight for the entire world to see and apparently approve of. The answer is a bit complex. What this account didn't mention is just after their birth, a promoter from Chicago approached their father and offered to pay him a large sum of money if he would agree to exhibit them. Their father initially accepted but quickly reneged when word got out and he appeared to be exploiting his children for money. Keep in mind, this was in the Great Depression. The Dion household had no electricity or running water. They lived in abject poverty. The promise of money was a godsend for someone who now had an additional five, not one, mouths to feed. Once the offer from Chicago had evaporated, the Canadian government stepped in to help. This was an uneasy relationship, and for the Dion father, who will not strike you as a caring, compassionate man, it appears he was initially fine with this arrangement. The government constructed the Defoe Nursery directly across the road from their house, where the children would be taken care of in a way the Dion household was likely unable to, and where they could easily be visited by their parents. As the quintuplets' notoriety and financial worth grew, their father began to ask for them back. The Canadian government played a large part in their exploitation and isolation from their family, but it's unclear that their parents initially objected to any of this. At the time, everyone was happy. The government was happy for the economic boost all of the tourism Quintland brought in, and the parents were happy to have their children taken care of and close by. Most of all, the girls had the best food, care, and toys any child in Canada could dream of. It was only later, as they grew up and became adults, that the negative effects of this arrangement were keenly felt. In the end, the Dion quintuplets make for a sad story. They had a very happy childhood, but it set them up for an extremely unhappy adulthood. Without the intervention of the Canadian government, they would have grown up with nothing and been unable to see the world as they did. They would have never stepped foot on a plane, would have never traveled abroad, and would have certainly never gotten to meet royalty. But even so, as they transitioned out of the cute, cuddly girls the world fell in love with and into five individuals, simple women that had lived their entire youth in near seclusion, their celebrity status faded, and they were wholly unprepared for life as adults. Some of you may be curious about the emergency tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies Dr. Defoe performed on the girls. I can't help but wonder why they were so frequently coming down with sore throats, and given the three doses of the aluminum-containing diphtheria vaccine they received so prominently in newspapers, I can't help but wonder if some of the initial secrecy around their operation was because their health woes were actually due to the diphtheria vaccine itself. The timing of this surgery holds additional curiosity, because through my research in trying to document the health woes of Emily, a few people mentioned remembering her coming down with what they thought was polio when she was 4 years old. For those of you unfamiliar with the polio story, as I've told it in The Moth and the Iron Lung, tonsillectomies were known to be associated with a risk of polio, bulbar polio, in fact, the worst kind of the illness. The reason? The bulb, or brainstem, lies directly behind where the surgery is performed, and the break in tissue can create exposed nerve endings, a ready-made portal for a virus to gain entry into the nervous system. This type of surgery was the most popular medical procedure in the United States at the time, a title it held for several decades, and children that received tonsillectomies during that era were known to have a higher chance of getting bulbar polio. The onset of bulbar polio presents another possibility, one that I've never heard discussed: autism. If the brainstem is in fact the epicenter of the neurological damage of autism, and under the right conditions, polio can start in this region, there is no reason to believe polio to be incapable of triggering autism. As I discuss in The Moth in the Iron Lung, polio, as it is now called, could actually be caused by many different viruses, not just poliovirus. Bulbar polio was incredibly rare because the brainstem is so well protected. Most polio started in children's legs, the location of which I believe to be caused by its immediate proximity to their intestines, where enteroviruses like poliovirus replicate. It would sometimes climb up their spinal cord, causing additional paralysis along the way. If it reached the upper section of the cord that innervated the muscles that allowed them to breathe, they could die, an event that would usually happen well before it had a chance to reach their brainstem. With tonsillectomies, the exposed tissue from surgery might allow a particular virus immediate access to the brainstem. If it crippled a sensitive region, such as the medullary reticular formation, their breathing could stop. It would be near instant death, and no iron lung would save them, an effect which we might call SIDS today. The obvious question many readers may be asking now is if I believe Emily had autism. Based on the descriptions of her behavior alongside the fainting spells, later to become grand mal seizures, I do believe she would receive an autism diagnosis today. She would most likely be placed in the mild category, but there is no doubt in my mind she was different than the other girls. If you have an internet connection, the Life magazine article that features their handwriting samples is very telling. Dysgraphia, a disability that affects one's handwriting and ability to communicate through written language, is frequently associated with autism. Other language her sisters use in describing her, alone, lost to herself. Along with the language deficiencies frequently mentioned, one cannot help but to imagine her receiving a diagnosis. Given my focus on facial asymmetry as a sign of brainstem injury, it is striking to hear of Marie's crossed eyes, or strabismus as we would now call it. Like Emily, she seemed to struggle with sickness, especially in her later years. Specifically, what she dealt with was never mentioned, so I can only assume it was not understood. Possibly an autoimmune condition of some sort, or mild enough, it just wasn't talked about. Although Donald Triplett is considered to be patient zero in Dr. Leo Connor's autism files, Alfred L. was seen a few years earlier, in November 1935, a person whose identity and life story no one, as far as I'm aware of, has been able to track down. I have never met Donald Triplett, but would love to spend time with him. His life represents so much of the hope and perseverance every parent whose child has received a diagnosis wants for them. A road trip to Forest, Mississippi is on my bucket list, and I'm hopeful I might be able to get a simple handshake, or even better, assigned a special number within his complex identification system by possibly the world's most interesting person. I have not been able to confirm if Donald Triplett received an aluminum-containing diphtheria vaccine. Most every child in America, particularly those of well-to-do parents, received the shot during that time. Well-funded public awareness campaigns regarding the shot were running seemingly everywhere, and mothers and fathers were understandably concerned about their children dying from the infection. It wasn't a remote possibility that struck rarely, like polio. It was a real danger. If Donald was vaccinated for diphtheria shortly after he was born, it would almost certainly have been the aluminum-containing shots. We do know the Dion girls were vaccinated 3 times with the aluminum-precipitated diphtheria vaccine. Something which may interest history buffs regarding Heller-Vaughan syndrome, an autism-like disorder I mentioned, which briefly appeared in early 1900s Austria. Isolated cases of people with autism do appear in medical literature before 1935. It was rare, but you can catch glimpses of it if you look hard enough. By reading through Charles Bell's accounts of nerve damage in the early 1800s, you will find obvious cases of people with what we would now call sensory processing disorder, usually alongside other issues that clearly point to metal poisoning. When a few children began experiencing the autism-like symptoms of what was labeled Heller-Vaughan syndrome, scientists in Germany were experimenting with alum in the diphtheria antitoxin being given. Two scientists named Freund and Sternberg published several reports starting at least as far back as 1899, documenting their techniques using alum to attempt to clean up diphtheria serum. They did not purposely leave the alum, as scientists would later begin to do in the 1930s, but regardless, it is interesting to find such a clear reference to alum being used in diphtheria injections in that very area of Europe, around the same time these few early cases of autism-like illness appeared. I tried to track down whether their solutions were being used in Austria, but couldn't confirm. Given their work was published in German, it's likely Austrian scientists had read of their methods. You may recall hearing recently about hundreds of dead children being discovered in the septic tank of a Catholic orphanage in Tuam, Ireland. It appears that the number of bodies found may have been overstated, and forensic examination places many of their deaths in the 1940s or 50s. But a disturbing fact remains. That orphanage was one of the sites used in testing an aluminum-containing diphtheria vaccine manufactured by Burroughs Wilcombe Laboratories, possibly in 1932, or 1933. There are some who believe the majority of these boys and girls may have died during the initial alum-precipitated diphtheria vaccine trials. While some of the children may have died during these trials, it likely would have been very few. Earlier tests in 1930 employed varying amounts of aluminum, some of them much higher than what would be used today, and if the data can be trusted, there were 0 deaths within those trials. The use of children from this orphanage in early tests of the aluminum-containing diphtheria vaccine is upsetting, and obviously something caused hundreds of children's deaths. But in reality, it was most likely disease due to malnutrition or poor medical care, not an experimental aluminum-precipitated diphtheria shot. One last curiosity regarding diphtheria and its impact on science and medicine that I left out of the story but wanted to include. As children were at risk of dying from the inflamed throats of the bacterial infection, often the only option was a tracheostomy, a surgical breathing hole cut directly into the windpipe. While this procedure is relatively risk-free today, it was extremely dangerous in the 1800s due to many surgeons' refusal to treat the risk of wound infection seriously. Joseph O'Dwyer, a physician and surgeon at the New York Foundling Asylum, came up with a graduated set of tubes that could be inserted into the sick children's throats, opening their airways to ensure they would not suffocate. Intubation, as it is now known, has become a crucial tool for any medical treatment facility and is so common, plastic versions of his invention are often included within first aid kits. The possibility that autism is an asymmetrical brainstem injury should provide some hope additional recovery techniques may be developed. Why the body prefers to route certain neurological functions like language on one side and not the other may be related to the asymmetry of the lymphatic system, but regardless, it might be possible, with these side preferences in mind, to design behavioral therapies that focus on transitioning what was lost onto the other side of the stem, where functionality is intact. It is still early on in this hypothesis, but I believe it may offer improvement for those who struggle with language or abstract thinking. For this reason, I think it is vital we conclusively determine whether the brainstem is the epicenter of autism and whether it is most often an asymmetrical injury or not. If these two hypotheses are true, it should narrow our focus and allow money to be spent more efficiently on a specific range of treatments. Learning to differentiate between the autism of encephalitis, particularly the chronic infections of the autoimmune variety, and the autism of neurotoxic damage is important. Each one has a different immunological profile, and with advances being made in treatments for autoimmune disease and aluminum chelation, the correct response, if recognized quickly, may ameliorate many of the symptoms children face. Like previous medical terms such as imbecile, moron, or mentally retarded, autism and Asperger's syndrome will likely soon be considered offensive, sunk to the bottom of the ocean by their own weight. We will find new terms that feel more optimistic, less painful, less encumbered by decades of misunderstanding and hurt. Someday soon, there may exist refined labels which offer us more specificity in the way we diagnose. Rather than autism, we might call it dominant side brainstem injury, and rather than Asperger's syndrome, we may call it non-dominant side brainstem injury. An unlucky few may get a bilateral brainstem injury diagnosis. Additional qualifiers may designate the extent of vertical damage along the brainstem, singling out whether the reticular formation was involved or not, while others may specify the source of injury, neurotoxic or encephalitic. Even these hypothetical terms may one day be felt as offensive. We are quickly approaching the 100-year anniversary of injecting metals into children. I hope that by then, in 2032, we will have been able to confront the demons we have created and take whatever steps are necessary to right the wrongs of the past 100 years. Whatever the nomenclature ends up being, whether autism or encephalitic dominant side brainstem injury, we will likely spend the anniversary of injected aluminum looking back on this period as a time of hopeless ignorance when we were blinded to the obvious truth sitting directly in front of us. That is my hope, at least. We have around a dozen years to begin to make a change. If we don't, the alternative will be far worse.